But the point is, they had a knowledge far in excess of the movements of the heavenly bodies than the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, or modern history in relationship to ancient times from 200 B.C. or rather A.D. to the 1500s. The puzzle of this ancient astrolabe can only be solved if one discards the notion that the Mesopotamians believed in a flat earth, and which is what tradition has said. And it can only be resolved if one recognizes that the Mesopotamian astronomical knowledge was as good as ours. Not because they had better instruments than we do, but because they had a source of information that gave it to them. And that source didn't necessarily need better instruments than we have. In this astrolabe complicated diagram put together by the Assyriologists, the enigmatic numbers represent degrees of the celestial arc, with the North Pole as the starting point. And the astrolabe was a planisphere, which is nothing other than the representation of a sphere on a flat surface. While the numbers increase and decrease, those in the opposite segments for the way of Enlil add up to 90. All those for the way of Anu add up to 180, and all those for the way of Ea add up to 360. These figures are too familiar to be misunderstood. They represent the segments of a complete spherical circumference, a quarter of the way 90 degrees, halfway 180 degrees, full circle 360. The numbers given, the numbers in each of these areas, the numbers given for the way of Enlil are so paired as to show that this Sumerian segment of the northern skies stretched over 60 degrees from the North Pole, bordering on the way of Anu at 30 degrees above the equator. The way of Anu was equidistant on both sides of the equator, reaching to 30 degrees south below the equator. Then further south and farthest away from the North Pole lay the way of Ea, that part of Earth and of the celestial globe that lay between 30 degrees south and the South Pole. The numbers of the way of Ea segments add up to 180 degrees in Adaru, February to March, and Lulu, August to September. The only point that is 180 degrees away from the North Pole, whether you go south on the east or on the west, is the South Pole. And this holds true only if one deals with a sphere. So without remembering the details, the diagram simply was a flat representation of a sphere. The way of Anu, the celestial band of the sun, planets and constellations of the zodiac, look at this diagram, lay along the equatorial band. The way of Enlil, in the northern skies, the way of Ea, in the southern skies, as you stood on this globe and looked at the sphere of the heavens. Now, precession of the equinoxes is the phenomenon caused by the wobble of the Earth's north-south axes, causing the North Pole, the one pointing at the North Star, and the South Pole to trace a grand circle in the heavens. The apparent retardation of Earth against the starry constellations amounts to about 50 seconds of an arc in 1 year, or 1 degree in 72 years. The grand circle, the time it takes the Earth's North Pole to point again at the same North Star, lasts 25,920 years, or 72 times 360. A little oversimplification, because it varies, but it's in the neighborhood of 26,000 years. And that is what the astronomers call the great year of the Plutonian year, for apparently Plato too was aware of the phenomenon. The ring and setting of various stars deemed significant in antiquity, and the precise determination of the spring equinox, which ushered in the new year, were related to the zodiacal house in which they occurred. Due to the precession, a phenomenon related to the wobble of the earth on its axis while it spins and goes around the sun, and the different pointing of the extension of the pole from south to north pole into the heavens. Every 2,000 years on its wobble, it points to a different star. And the rising and setting of various stars and the precise determination of the spring equinox were related to the zodiacal house in which they occurred. Due to precession, the precession of the equinoxes, the spring equinox and other celestial phenomena, being retarded from year to year, were finally retarded once in 2,160 years, or more accurately, approximately 2,000 years, by a full zodiacal house. Our astronomers continue to employ a zero point, the first point of Aries, which marked the spring equinox in 900 BC. But this point has by now shifted well into the house of Pisces. AD 2100, the spring equinox will begin to occur in the preceding house of Aquarius. This is what is meant by those who say we are about to enter the age of Aquarius. And the North Star will change when we move into the 2,000-year period of Aquarius. Pretty smart people, weren't they? To be able to map those things when our modern television-educated audience just about gets lost even talking about it. Except for my audience. Because the shift from one zodiacal house to another takes more than 2,000 years, scholars wondered how and where Hipparchus could have learned of the precession of the 2nd century B.C. It is now clear that his source was Sumerian. Professor Langdon's findings reveal that the Nippurian calendar, established about 4,400 B.C. in the age of Taurus, reflects knowledge of the precession and the shift of zodiacal houses that took place 2,160 years earlier than that. As the builders of the pyramid could predict in the precession of the equinoxes the exact date that would line up Alcyone in the Pleiades and Alpha Draconis in the dragon constellation to give the benchmark of the dates in the prophetic plan in the pyramid. Somebody was awful smart. Professor Jeremias, who correlated Mesopotamian astronomical texts with Hittite astronomical texts, was also of the opinion that older astronomical tablets recorded the change from Taurus to Aries. And he concluded that the Mesopotamian astronomers predicted and anticipated the shift from Aries to Pisces. Subscribing to these conclusions, Professor Wiley Hartner, in The Earliest History of the Constellations in the Near East, suggested that the Sumerians... You're killing me with this mic. Suggest get the base out of it. Take it all out. I mean, I've been fighting and I've been telling you it's in the mix. Don't touch any button but the mix. You get the base out of this thing and I might be able to talk. Or find me another machine that the battery isn't about out of. That had nothing to do with you. God, I wish I had a Sumerian here to fix my microphone. Professor Wiley Hartner suggested that the Sumerians left behind plentiful. Did you make them put their hands in their pocket when I told you to leave it there about an hour ago? You sure? They've been playing around with some buttons. Buttons. Subscribing to these conclusions, Professor Wiley Hartner suggested that the Sumerians left behind plentiful pictorial evidence to that effect. When the spring equinox was in the zodiac of Taurus, the summer solstice occurred in the zodiac of Leo. Hartner drew attention to the recurrent motive of a bull-lion combat appearing in Sumerian depictions from earliest times, and suggested that these motifs represented the key positions of the constellation of Taurus the bull and Leo the lion to an observer at 30 degrees north, such as at Ur, circa 4000 BC. Most scholars consider the Sumerian stress of Taurus as their first constellation as evidence not only of the antiquity of the zodiac, dating it to 4000 BC, because it's gone through two separate constellation houses to the present, but also testifying to the time when Sumerian civilization so suddenly began. Professor Jeremias, in the Old Testament in the Light of the Ancient East, found evidence, you're getting there, showing that the Sumerian, don't touch anything now, leave the buttons alone, found evidence showing that the Sumerian zodiacal chronological point zero stood precisely between the bull and the twins. From this and other data, he concluded that the zodiac was devised in the age of Gemini, the twins. That is, even before Sumerian civilization began. A Sumerian tablet in the Berlin Museum, VAT 7847, begins the list of zodiacal constellations with that of Leo, taking us back to 11,000 BC. Professor H.V. Hilprecht, in the Babylonian expedition of the University of Pennsylvania, went even further, studying thousands of tablets bearing mathematical tabulations. He concluded that, quote, all the multiplication and division tables from the temple libraries of Nippur and Sippar and from the library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh are based upon the number 12960000. 12,960,000. Analyzing this number and its significance, he concluded that it could be related only to the phenomenon of the precession, and that the Sumerians knew of the great year of 25,920 years. This is indeed fantastic astronomical sophistication at an impossible time. Just as it is evident that the Sumerian astronomers possessed knowledge that they could not possibly have acquired on their own, so is there evidence to show that a good deal of their knowledge was of no practical use to them. What do they have it for? Like some of them buttons they got up there. No practical use to them. Just as it is evident that Sumerian astronomers possessed knowledge that they could not possibly have acquired on their own, so is there evidence to show that a good deal of their knowledge was of no practical use to them. The suggestion being, since it was of no practical use, these practitioners, the Sumerians, wouldn't have developed it in their practice. Like scholastic education studied Latin, not because we used Latin, but because predecessors did. This pertains not only to the very sophisticated astronomical methods that were used. Who in ancient summer really needed to establish a celestial equator, for example, out in the heavens? Very important to us, particularly if you're riding in a shot to the moon. You're trying to send a space probe past Uranus. I like it when it gets late. No practical use to that. Who in ancient summer really needed to establish a celestial equator, for example, but also to a variety of elaborate texts that dealt with the measurement of distances between the stars? Why did they need that? One of these texts, known as AO 6478, lists the 26 major stars visible along the line we now call the Tropic of Cancer, and gives distances between them as measured in three different ways. The text first gives the distances between these stars by a unit called Mana Shukultu, that is, measured and weighed. It is believed that this was an ingenious device that related the weight of escaping water to the passage of time, just as we now use carbon-14 as a dating method. It made possible the determination of distances between two stars in terms of time. Pretty sophisticated measuring devices. The second column of distances was in terms of degrees of the arc of the skies. The full day, daylight, and nighttime were divided into 12 double hours. The arc of the heavens comprised a full circle of 360 degrees. Hence one biru, or double hour, represented 30 degrees of the arc of the heavens. By this method, passage of time on Earth provided a measure of the distances in degrees between the named celestial bodies. Very sophisticated. The third method of measurement they used was Beru Inashami, lengthen the skies. Eftherodangan, in his French work, Distances Between Fixed Stars, pointed out that while the first two methods were relative to other phenomena, this third method provided absolute measurements. A celestial Biru, he and others pointed out, was equivalent to 10,692 of our present-day meters, or 11,693 yards. The distance in the skies between the 26 stars was calculated in the text as adding up to 655,200 Biru drawn in the skies. The availability of three different methods of measuring distance between stars conveys the great importance attached to the matter. Yet who among the men and women of summer needed such knowledge? I mean, you know, were they going to play baseball between the stars? Who among them could devise the methods and accurately use them? The only possible answer is someone else had the knowledge and the need for such accurate measurements. Now, he doesn't say someone else. He has his theory of who. I just skipped over that. I have my theory of who. But we agree. The Sumerians didn't come up with it. They got it from somebody else, or someone else, or something else. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Against this background of knowledge and measurement of the stars given to them, can it be assumed that the Mesopotamian astronomers, guided by this source of knowledge they had, were not aware of the planets beyond Saturn, that they didn't know of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto? Was their knowledge of Earth's own family, the solar system, less complete than that of distant stars, their order, and their distances? I'm going to skip ahead real quickly. Here is, get over here real fast. Here just get the diagram from here down. Come on, Peter. Here to the bottom. Get them both. Go ahead, I haven't got all of it, Peter. All of it up here. There. Now, zoom in on just this one. This is a diagram laid out of the universe as we know it in relative sizes. Sun, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, Mercury, Venus, Earth with its moon, and Mars. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Here is the ancient Sumerian layout. Sun, Jupiter, let's get them both, Peter, if you can. Sun, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. For some strange reason, Pluto is in a different place between Saturn and Uranus. But it's there. Venus and Mercury, side by side, though in respective sizes the same, whereas here their position a bit different. Earth with its moon and Mars. But there is a 12th planet, smaller than Jupiter, larger than Mars, added. Now, it wasn't until 1930 we discovered Pluto by watching the gravitational pull on Uranus. Now, with the superior knowledge of the Sumerians, what are they doing putting an extra 12th planet in? That reminds me of the Dogon people. They saw an extra body moving, located it, knew its orbit that couldn't be seen, until modern astronomy discovered the white dwarf. And then they discovered that the Dogon people, who built their entire religious concept in Mali and Central Africa, were right. They didn't gain that knowledge themselves. They inherited it from someone who told them, and they worshipped around. They claimed the fish man came from there and brought them this knowledge. Now, the whole evening was moving toward this point. The superior knowledge of the heavenly bodies exhibited by the Sumerians, who were closer to some original source of knowledge who gave it to them, had a 12th planet there. Now, white dwarfs have been pretty hard to find, way out there. You still can't see a black hole, which is a collapsed star or body that has been crushed to such a mass that its gravitational pull will capture light, so you therefore can't see it. What is this 12th planet? Now, he has his theory. Well, you don't care. I mean, have the Sumerians exhibited an accuracy of knowledge at least to give them credence for projecting a 12th planet that's not on our... That's a long time ago. Was there a planet that did exist that doesn't exist now? That was in the cosmogony given and the picture of the heavenly reality given, that these people took per se from whomever gave it to them? Somebody back there knew something I'd like to know.